No, it is very, very much a narrative-driven world and a media-driven world. We can live in a kind of hyper-reality that exists at one level in the media space or in the dissemination of information space, and then there's the actual facts on the ground, and those two things are rarely intersect. And when they do, they intersect in such a way that somebody's always kind of trying to shape them to move a market in a particular direction or gain themselves some kind of political advantage or whatever, however you want to talk about it.
Good day, everybody. It's me, Just Steve Yang, here with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I'm joined by Tom Luongo, Gold, Goats, and Guns. Tom, great to have you on here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate the invite. It's good to meet you. Well, yeah, I mean, we met last weekend in Atlanta at Andy's conference, which was great.
You had a lot of great things to say, and love to get some of your thoughts here. But I wanted to get you on because I've heard so much about you. Even people who don't agree with you find you a respectable voice. So I wanted to kind of get you on here myself and kind of pick your brain. And maybe we might not agree with everything, but I'm sure that I've got lots to learn from you. So thank you for being here. I wanted to start off by talking about, you know, George Orwell's Animal Farm?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, when I read that, you know, in high school, it was articulated as a us good guys versus them bad guys. And since then, you know, my view has shifted where I've become more and more skeptical and cynical about how the world works and how narratives are shaped and strategically used. And so I wanted to get, you know, your thoughts, you know, in today's world, you know, how coordinated is it? How coordinated and strategic does it get where messages, you know, cross politics, finance, and media come together? And does it ever cross the line where it's information control and censorship?
That's an interesting opening question for a natural resource doc podcast. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that as like some kind of like, I'm like angry or pejorative or anything. No, like that's an interesting opening. Didn't expect to talk about it. Animal Farm this morning, but no, that's kind of my shtick, to be honest with you. So like, it's almost like it's a softball, but it's a little bit of a, not the softball I was expecting, to be honest with you. And don't get me wrong, Steve, I'm like, I'm just funning with you mostly. No, it is very, very much a narrative driven world and a media driven world. We can live in a kind of hyper reality, that, exists at one level in the media space or in the dissemination of information space, and then there's the actual facts on the ground, and those two things are rarely intersect. And when they do, they intersect in such a way that somebody's always kind of trying to shape them to move a market in a particular direction or gain themselves some kind of political advantage or whatever, however you want to talk about it. So how much of that is driven purely by intelligence services? How much of it is just driven by, the alchemy of enlightened self-interest and the studious application of capital? That's for you to kind of, wrestle with, or any, for the listener to wrestle with. For me, I tend to assume narrative first and fact second, and then let them prove to me that they're actually discussing facts, because 9 times out of 10, they're not discussing facts and they're generally driving a narrative. So I have a couple of basic heuristics when it comes to stuff like that. They're lying to me until proven otherwise is the big one. And so when I see, for example, I mean, like, let's just talk about this way. So this morning we're doing this on Friday, May 8th. And the jobs report just came out, and the jobs report blew away expectations by over 100,000 jobs. Now, we're going to dig into that jobs report, and we're going to find out that there's probably some massaging of that data. There's probably too many H-1Bs, visas, involved in that number versus Americans actually being hired. But in general, a number that big versus quote unquote expectations, the question now you have to ask yourself is, where did the expectations come from? Right? Who wrote those expectations? Right? It's just like earnings expectations, yep. Right? I have this conversation almost every quarter with Dexter White when it comes to Apple. for example, right? And every quarter, about a week before the earnings report, he'll come out and say, oh, some dumb kid over at Goldman pulled a number out of his ass and, you know, made that the new expectation number. And then the market sets on that. And then Apple comes in and blows it away. And you're like, okay, so someone's trying to manipulate the market or someone's trying to do something. Yeah. Everybody wants to be the first one to call the top in Apple is really what it comes down to. And in that respect, if you're talking about, you know, markets, if you're talking about geopolitics, look, at the end of the day, geopolitics is war by other means, right? And so what's the first casualty of war? The truth. So you always have to read between the lines of whatever anybody's saying. Are you a sports fan? Steve, are you a sports fan?
Huge hockey fan.
Okay, so you know what GM speak is, right? You know when a GM is speaking about a particular player or contract negotiation or whatever, you know they're lying about everything, right? Like, everybody has to like it. Sometimes the GMs actually tell you the truth. It doesn't happen often, but every once in a while, we hear it so rarely that we don't trust it. So it's the same thing in geopolitics. Foreign ministers never tell you the truth. You know, secretaries of state never tell you the truth. Presidents don't tell you the truth, right? So, and then when every once in a while, when you hear the truth, because after you've stripped away all the narrative and you've stripped away all the, frankly, the bullshit, and then someone just says, hey, oh, by the way, here's the truth. Like no one believes it. Right. So, and learning how to separate the truth from the narrative and knowing the extent to which they're lying to you, that's kind of a superpower. That takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time to work out. So your answer to your question in the short term is really simple, or the short answer is really simple. Yeah, they're lying to us all the time. Almost everything is narrative, especially when it comes to the intersection of geopolitics and markets, because one begets the other. And then the fact check on both things is the other one, right? Markets will fact check the geopolitics, whatever said at the propaganda level, really, really well, and vice versa. Sometimes the markets are speaking and then they say, and then the geopolitics says something otherwise. And you have to kind of be able to navigate back and forth. What you really have to do is have a thesis about what the theory of action is of and the incentives are of the major players, and then understand that they're always acting in their best interests. And then watch how they lie and how they tell the truth and to what extent they do both at any moment in time. So, and it's very difficult. Don't get me wrong. I mean, average person, but just the normal person, like, it's very difficult to navigate that. Yeah. You have to really tune into it. So go ahead.
Yeah. So Tom, based off the fact check, I also want, you know, really brought that whole Animal Farm up because, you know, I would like your take on what's going on in Iran. You know, there's so much narrative, you know, what's actually happening on the ground versus the headlines. And how much does that gap show up in the markets? Love your take.
So, let's start with the markets, and then let's back calculate from there. Because what I did yesterday, I wrote a tweet yesterday trying to remind everybody about, you know, whose lies should you believe, and who's, you know, when someone says something and they're quote unquote trying to manipulate the market, because that's been the story for the last 48 hours, right? Yeah. There was a, you know, big oil trade at 720, you know, short and then long, and someone was profiting on both sides of the trade. It was clearly the guy who was feeding Axios from the Iranian side, because if you stop and you think about the situation on the ground in Iran, in the Straits of Hormuz. This is what I said yesterday. I'm like, well, the United States has money. The United States has hard power. The United States has oil to export. The United States has time. The United States has a reputation to uphold, ultimately. Who doesn't have any of those things? Iran. I really mean the IRGC, because Iran is a country at war with itself, and I could do a half an hour on just trying to explain what the hell's going on inside Iran at this point. But let's just assume, for at the moment, that Iran is not a monolith, because it's not. There's clearly the civilian government on one side. There's clearly the IRGC on the other, or the remnants of the IRGC, which are now kind of splintering into different factions. Right? Reality is that Donald Trump is not going to torch any reputation the United States has for short-term gain in oil prices. If you look at a weekly chart of Brent crude, right, and you're a halfway decent chart analyst, you'll look at it and go, someone's desperately trying to hold the price of oil up when the price of oil clearly wants to come down, right? There's a lot of gaps between the Friday close and the Monday open. There's all sorts of weird stuff. But if you just like draw a big dome over the, a big arrow, the dome-shaped arrow over the last 7, 8 weeks of trading in Brent crude, you can see that the market really wants to drop. Okay. And clearly Donald Trump doesn't want oil prices at $110 a barrel. Okay, so he's incented to move the markets down. So he can come in and say, look, we're negotiating with Iran. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who's got power inside of Iran wants to negotiate with the United States, right? The IRGC clearly wants to keep the war running because to them, their strategy is a propaganda strategy, a soft power strategy to keep the price of oil up with the theory of action that that will hurt Donald Trump politically at home. Therefore, they can get rid of him at the midterms and then we can get back to, globalist status quo because that's where I think all of that action from the IRGC portends that they're on that side of the divide, that the Iran itself is not the target of Donald Trump and this whole thing. They're just the network node. They're the target to get to the real actor, which is who controls the price, the who has pricing control over a barrel of oil, which Donald Trump wants to be in charge of, not a bunch of crazy, non-agreement capable death cultists who negotiate the exact same way as a bunch of non-agreement capable communists and fascists in the European Union do. And the Ukrainians do, and everybody, and all of their other, and I mean, all these people are proxies for them because Iran itself is not powerful enough as a as an actor to be considered to be an equal on this stage. Anybody trying to equate Iran and the United States and geopolitical importance is an idiot. I'm gonna be just like, let's just brass tacks here. Cards on the table. Iran is a third world country with a third world economy and a third world ability to garner capital. If they weren't, they wouldn't be in the position they're in today. Now, is for it doesn't, and I don't say that with any animosity towards Iran. I say it with animosity towards the people who are trying to equate Iran with the United States, which is insane. Like, so clearly someone is using Iran as a proxy for their geopolitical interests. Now, who would that be? Is it Russia? Is it China? Is it the EU? Is it all of the above? Is it two of, is it A and B or B and C or all three or all three consecutively concurrently? What I would say to you is that it's all of it, it is all of the above, but in but there's an order of priority. The Chinese just want a stable trade route and stable oil flows out of Iran. They don't really want anything more than that, right? They don't, I mean, that's what they want. The Russians want an international, want a stable trade route north and south to the international north-south transport corridor. They want to, they want maybe to outsource some of their drone production. That's what do they want? And they also want to complicate any imperial ambitions of the so-called West. That's when the United States is working with the commies in Europe, right? Which is what we had under Obama and the Biden junta and under the Bushes and going backwards. That United States, which is the problem here, we have a United States that's also at war with itself. That United States is clearly something that the Russians have to worry about because the United States plus Europe and then and then subordinating the other Gulf states on the Arabian Peninsula. Oh yeah, that's a problem in the long run for the Russians. That's like the Cold War in a nutshell, right? Like that is literally 90% of the Cold War in that respect. It's not just Eastern Europe. It's clearly, all the oil machinations and the building of the offshore dollar system during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, right? So you have to view why the Russians made decisions that they did when they were the Soviet Union and even when they and now today under Putin, their motivations haven't changed. Their desired outcomes have are different, right? But their motivations aren't really different. So and so the Russians are interested in Iran from that perspective, right? If the United States, a country at war with itself, winds up with globalists that are aligned with Europe back in power in 2 years, well, then they have to be positioned in such a way that they can figure out a way to stop that. But neither Russia nor China have any problems with what Donald Trump is trying to pull off with the United States, which is to extricate it from all of the post-World War II globalist institutions like the UN, NATO, and all the rest of it. He's trying to deprecate all of that. He's trying to deprecate the post-World War II Gulf Cooperation Council, you know, OPEC, so that world. He wants that world to be over. He wants to shift the center of power away from the Middle East and Europe and over to the Americas, right? That's his Don Rowe doctrine. You know, that's the TLDR on the Don Rowe doctrine. Now, in that world, the Russians and the Chinese are okay because they now have a United States that is looking out for its own interests, is not a subordinate operating in conjunction with the old colonial powers of Europe, who have a historical hate on and hatred for everything Russian and in many ways everything Chinese. Right, because Europe has always seen Russia as a potential unifying power. Russia and China is potentially Europe unifying powers for Asia, right? And they want to control the maritime choke points that are the access points to Europe, right? And so, from a European perspective, all those maritime choke points are existential points of access. So they need to control them. Right. I mean, you can sum up British foreign policy in many ways for 300 years as don't let the Russians get a warm water port. Right. Mm-hmm. And why is it? That's why they're so butthurt over Crimea. That's why they won't let Zelensky negotiate away a permanent settlement over the status of Crimea. They still keep saying that Crimea is Ukraine. It's not. It's been Russia for 12 years now. But somehow we're supposed to still believe this fiction. Right, that Crimea is not Russia. It's not. It's not Ukraine anymore. It hasn't been Ukraine for 12 years. Doesn't matter whether you like how the Russians quote unquote took it over or not. Does not matter. Facts on the ground, and we're talking facts. We're not talking opinions. We're not talking legal. We're not talking international law. None of that. None of that matters now, because international law and all of these ideas, all these concepts, they all came out of Europe anyway. They were all imposed on everybody else. And they could impose that will upon everybody else, those institutions, that law structure, yada, 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 when they were the dominant industrial power of the world in the 19th and early 20th centuries. They're not anymore. The United States and China are. And the preeminent military powers in the world are the United States and Russia, and soon to be China. So at the end of the day, all of those powers are saying to themselves, we don't need you. And if you watch really carefully, all of the wrangling and the manipulation of things that are happening, you realize that what Europe has been trying to do, and certainly you can watch like Mark Carney in Canada as a proxy, you can watch, they've all been trying to separate the United States, trying to triangulate between the United States and China, right? They've been doing that all year. Mark Carney goes to Beijing right before Davos. Donald Trump goes to Davos, brings 200 people with him and declares that globalism is dead and we're re-implementing the Hamiltonian / Henry Clay system of American production, yada, yada, yada. Like all of these things that we've been talking about. And, you know, how many times did European leaders like von der Leyen, former foreign minister of Germany, Annalena Baerbock, who's now at the UN. You know, she failed as German foreign minister, and now she's a major player over at the UN, right? These people all went to China, and they were met by the doorman. Donald Trump is going over having a real state visit. He's already, like, landed two C-17s worth of stuff in order to do a full state visit in Beijing. He's going to be treated like royalty. These people, you know, get off the bus, and they're like, you know, and there's a janitor and a couple of doormen and an Uber driver.
Yeah.
Like these things matter, right? So when you look at the way Iran is being dealt with, it's clear that Donald Trump poked the snake in Iran because Iran has always been secretly their proxy for creating chaos and controlling the flow of oil around the world and controlling global trade around the world. And so now you ask yourself, okay, is that a consistent strategy? And what's their, if that's a consistent strategy, what is that strategy? Well, the strategy is not hard. Create a choke point and put up a toll booth. What has Iran tried to do since the beginning of the war? Create a choke point and put up a toll booth. What have the British done with since the outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine war? They tried to put up a, to create a choke point on the North Sea and effectively put up a toll booth by refusing anybody shipping insurance who's carrying who wants to buy Russian oil, right? Same thing with, Keir Starmer handing Gibraltar back to the Spanish. Why? In order to deny the United States at the proper moment access to the shipping lanes and the airspace. So Donald Trump turns around and makes a deal with Indonesia over the Straits of Malacca and Morocco over Gibraltar. Why? In order to deal with the problem that is the intransigence that is Europe. So what he's done is he's actually exposed the decades-long, soft relationship between the IRGC, who are their chaos node, their chaos army, their army of chaos. Let's just put it that way. Their army of darkness, their army of chaos. While all of their banks launder money through the UAE and Hong Kong and Canada and London and all the rest of it, right? And remember that Iran has, a lot of influence in the Western Hemisphere through Hezbollah as well, and that's another reason why we went into and took out Maduro in Venezuela, why we're pressuring Cuba, and why we're going after the cartels in Mexico. This is all about securing the Gulf of America as the new center of global trade. Because the interesting part about it, when you just look, this is again, it's one of those things where when I sit down and talk to my partner at Gold Goats and Guns, Dexter White, he's like, "This is why I have a globe. Every time I get confused about global events, I turn off the news feed and he's like, I just pick up a globe and I start looking at it, right, from a variety of perspectives. And when you look at the globe from a, when you look at a globe differently than the way we're all trained to look at it, which is that Europe and the Middle East are in the center of the world and everything else is in the edges of the world, you realize the globe is much, the world is much more interesting than that. So when you shift the globe to North and South America, and now look at Europe as the periphery, and China hoves into view, and Western Russia, or sorry, Eastern Russia and Japan and the Korean Peninsula hove into view, all of a sudden, the world looks a lot different. And you also realize that there's only one physical choke point into or out of the Gulf of America, and that's the Panama Canal, and we control it. The rest of the quote unquote eastern side of the Gulf of America is open. It's wide open. You can't put up a toll booth around that. So all you can do is watch ships come stream in and out, and there's nobody can stand there with them. You can't have Colonel Habib, I'm a dumbass at Jihad with a man pad and the other guy with a GoPro, threatening ships on a barrier island. It doesn't work. That guy gets blown up. There's no caves for him to hide in. There's no bullshit. Like, let's just, brass tacks, facts matter, physical realities matter, right? And the rest of it is just soft power narratives. And that's the last thing to say on this and to remind everybody is I've been thinking about, I came to this idea about, just about what I'm about to say, in thinking about how they were attacking the United States and how they were sowing division within the US. And my fear of them blowing the United States apart made me go, whoa, they're trying to start a color revolution and an intelligence-based civil war here in the United States. How do you deal with, and then we've watched, and I've watched Putin and others, but mostly Putin, and advise people on how to beat the color revolution system. Go look at Kazakhstan, go look at Belarus, go look at a couple of other places where he's succeeded in beating the color revolution system. And you'll realize the color revolutions are intelligence-based. They're built on soft power, propaganda, radicalizing people who have a beef with the current government, amplifying that beef, handing them weapons, handing them money, handing them, a favorable press and everything else, and then using that as a means by which to freeze the military at the moment when they go and try and take the government over and then justify it as, freedom, right? That's the color revolutionary playbook in a nutshell. Well, how do you beat that? You beat that with hard military power. You beat that by having the military take aside, unfreeze the military, make sure that the military is capable of still moving, and the current leadership gets the backing of the military. Because spooks versus soldiers, spooks lose every time. Snipers versus, a battalion, snipers lose, right? It's the same thing. Spooks, spies are only powerful until they're found, and then they're killed. And once you out all the spies, once you out all of the intelligence assets, right, then you realize, oh, all that matters now is the police and the military. And so what Trump has proven to the world with first Venezuela and now with Iran, both attacks on Iran, is that the US military has no peer by an order of magnitude. And if he's willing to deploy that military in a hard power arrangement, ain't fuck all anybody can do about it. So now you're not going to, so you, Iran, are not going to have a nuclear weapon. You are not going to blackmail the world and turn yourself into, North Korea with a, Islam North Korea or Shia North Korea. That's a better way of putting it, Shia North Korea. Thousands of ballistic missiles to punish all of their neighbors and a nuclear shield, underneath which would be the new version of the financial center that is that where the globalists, in this case, what I like to call Davos, or you can call them City of London. City of London is just the current outpost, right? Used to be in Amsterdam, then it was in, it used to be in Venice, and it was in Amsterdam, now it was in London. Why? Because the English Channel was the most important choke point in the world back in the 19th century, 18th, 19th century. Now it's not. Now it's the quote unquote the Strait of Hormuz or the Straits of Malacca, right? So they have outposts on every one of those, right? And they were going to decamp to one of them, and clearly they were going to decamp to Dubai, and now we flipped Dubai, we flipped the UAE completely, and we're having wiped out Iran. So the only place left for them is the only geographic choke point left for them of with any military prowess is Turkey. Right? Turkey has the largest army left. They have deep ties. The mother, with Erdogan as the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, with Turkish banks having been laundering Iranian oil money for years, and a very vibrant gold trade and a variety of other things, they still control the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, right? So, okay.
So, Tom, a couple questions. One, you mentioned the U.S. being at war with itself, and that seems to be a strategy on the from the other end. If you can talk a little bit more about what that is and who is wanting that, who is pushing that, why that's important. And secondly, I would love to get your thoughts. I mean, you talked about the looking at the world differently. I'd love to understand kind of the major players that you see. You mentioned China, Russia, the US. Love to get your understanding of how to understand geopolitics right now. Where are the tectonic plates? Who are the major players? And love to get your insight on the current administration's playbook. You mentioned oil, you mentioned, choke points, you mentioned control of natural resources. Is there more than that? And why is there such a discrepancy with the narratives we're hearing in the media?
Well, the last question is the easiest. Who loses in the scenario where the United States is dominant and independent and willing to cut, and willing to carve the world up with Russia and China? Clearly Europe. And who controls all, and who controls most of the media? Who controls the Financial Times? Who controls the Wall Street Journal? Who controls the BBC, which is in every country in the world? Sky News. Ask yourself that question. Like, you realize that the London press is everywhere. They control most of our media as well. We have a, and then of course we have legacy relationships between the MI6 and CIA. And Mossad, and there, and none of those organizations are monoliths. Other than I would argue MI6 at this point. I see MI6 as wholly on mission to protect what's left of the British Empire, and I see the CIA as a rapidly fracturing organization. Some of whom are loyal to the United States, and some of whom are loyal to they're British benefactors. And the same thing I believe with the Mossad at this point as well, which is why it's so very difficult to figure out who is and who isn't in, you know, who's on what side. And when everybody, when you break down, you know, when you use like terms like the Mossad and everybody like has a, you know, gets triggered and sees X, Y, and Z, when you realize the Mossad clearly, and certainly Israeli politics, I'm going to get off of this in a second, but clearly if you just spend 5 minutes like honestly assessing the situation in Israeli politics, you'd be like, oh my God, it's more complicated than ours. If you're an American, you understand the hate between the United, between the Democrats and the Republicans and all the little factions and all the all the geographical differences and how do you keep this group on side, right? I watched a video on YouTube the other day. A guy was like, you know, talked about the 12 different, you know, if the United States were to break up, it should break up into these 13 different countries because of the geographical cultures. Like there's at least 13 different geographic cultures and within the United States. It was really interesting. I didn't agree with everything he presented, but it was an interesting concept, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't think it would be, you know, if the United States would break up, I don't think it would break up into 13 countries. I think it would break up into about four, right? But and clearly that's what Europe is playing, and certainly what the British are playing for, and certainly Mark Carney in Canada is playing for. And they're all going to fail. It's going to be hilarious. But let's talk about the United States at war with itself. I mean, how is anybody, you know, is anybody confused that we have a legislature and a judiciary that's been nothing but intransigent, saying no to everything that Donald Trump is trying to get done, and you know, oh, he's not MAGA enough. Well, is John Thune MAGA? Like, really, Robert Barnes? Like, what are we talking about here? You know, clearly this guy is not doing anything to fix our election system. He's not doing anything to advance the president's agenda. He's in complete and full-throated opposition to it, and yet he's a Republican. And so people, the average person looks up and goes, why can't the Republicans get anything done? It's because the Republicans are party at war with themselves, because clearly what Trump has done is exposed the deep divisions within even the parties, right, themselves, and the regional problems that we have. If you were to look at a map, Steve, and you were to If you were a maritime empire, right, fading, you know, the drapes are all 100 years old, and you don't really have as much money as you thought you had. You've got all these ancestral lands, you've got all this stuff, and you know, the old British imperial system. You know, you're aging out. You're not nearly as hot as you're the starlet at 60, still putting on the pancake makeup and the soft focus and, you know, the Vaseline on the lens when you go off for the paparazzi tour, right? You're not the same, you're not as important as you used to be, but you want to be, and you want to continue to, you don't want to give that up, right? You've been in power for God knows how many years. You're not as powerful as you used to be. I mean, I argue, you know, about City of London being, oh my God, City of London is a pain in the ass. I'm not arguing from the perspective that they're powerful. I'm arguing from the perspective of they want to remain powerful, that when they have soft power, we have hard power, and they're finding out that their soft power doesn't work anymore. So what's their soft power? Their soft power is political power by owning certain, you know, politicians on Capitol Hill, on still running certain state legislatures in certain quote unquote red states. Like, for example, Indiana. How many people, you know, until Indiana voted against redistricting the state, right? Which with a supermajority in the GOP, should have been easy slam dunk to get rid of all the race-based, right, insane districts they have in Indiana. And you realize, you know, like you take 5 minutes with AI and you go do a quick, and you ask some simple question like, who are the five biggest employers in the state of Indiana? And then you realize that like they're Rolls Royce and, you know, they're all British. BP, Rolls Royce, this. I'm like, oh, really? Where did Mike Pence come from? Indiana. Like you go, oh. So they were always like, at some point they were going to like use it. Yeah. You know, no one ever thought about this. Everybody was just looking at Indiana, go solid red. Don't worry about it. You know, 11 electoral votes for the president, you know, or whatever, however many electoral votes they have, and never think about it. But when push came to shove and they wanted to continue to draw map of the House districts in order to shade the midterm elections, in order to keep the status quo away from what Donald Trump is trying to do. Ooh. All of a sudden, Indiana is really damned important. All of a sudden, we learn about how screwed up the whole state is. I heard this from like half a dozen, after the redistricting thing, I had like half a dozen patrons in Indiana explain all this to me, because they're like on the ground. They're like businessmen and, you know, guys who work for BP and blah, blah, you know, like, and they're like coming out and going, oh, by the way, I'm like, I didn't know a damn thing about Indiana. I'm like everybody else. I'm an idiot. I don't know any better, right? I don't think about, you know. So we don't know this stuff until this stuff gets exposed. And you don't expose that kind of situation until you put pressure on it. Otherwise, it just sits and ticking away in the background, doing its thing. And you and we all sit there and go, why doesn't anything ever get done? Oh, this is why things don't get done. This is why things don't happen. What does Donald Trump do? He comes in and says, no, we're going to blow all that out wide open. We're gonna have a plan to not lose the midterms. What's our plan to not lose the midterms? We're gonna redistrict the entire country and like take 20 seats away from the Democrats. And then when they're getting out spent and outraised 10-1 by Donald Trump. And then what happened in Indiana the other night during the primary? Every state senator who voted against redistricting the state got primaried. All seven of them. All of them. They all got shit canned. Meaning, we're going to replace, you know, the state government in Indiana is going to fundamentally shift going forward, right? That means that we're going to have a shift in electoral politics at the national level. It's a country at war with itself. Now, go back to what I was saying originally. You're the aging out British Empire. Where's your power base? Where have you spent money to have a power base that encodes your globalist climate change, anti-Russian, Yankee style, you know, Tory loyalism, that kind of upper middle class or middle to upper middle class, you know, overeducated midwit that perfectly describes your average Democrat voter in the Northeast and the left coast and in and around the Great Lakes. Do they not look an awful lot like the people in Canada who got so friggin' angry at Trump calling Canada the 51st state? They're the exact same people, except they have a slightly different accent. Note, those states control all the major waterways and the major ports into and out of the United States. The St. Lawrence River Valley, all the ports on the Northeast, all the way down to D.C., Chesapeake Bay, and the left coast, ports of Los Angeles, ports of Seattle, right? Huh, I wonder why. Because you're trying to take those ports away from Trump so that when he makes the move on the Gulf of America, he doesn't have those as, you know, he needs not just the Gulf of America, but he needs those ports as well. Because with all of that taken together, the old world becomes very, very, very uninteresting from a trade hub's perspective. And so if you reindustrialize America, control the ports, control the Gulf of America, upgrade Central America and the Caribbean, and start the process of upgrading South America. They don't have any, they have no power over us anymore. They have no ability to project power anyway, right? They don't have any navies anymore. They've lost on the share of GDP front. They don't have the living standards in Europe that they did before, right? So now what? So this is, they want to, they don't know how to lose, but they can't win either. So all they can do is bring everybody down. And if you look at the way their, all of the institutions operate, the WTO, the WHO, the OECD, all of this stuff, and you look at this, the totality of those organizations, and then you look at things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all the globalist trade deals that Obama negotiated, you realize that all it is, you know, the Lilliputians trying to bind down Gulliver. And the United States is Gulliver. And it's been going on since the end of World War II. We spent our blood and treasure to rebuild Europe, and then Europe turned around and said, okay, now that you've rebuilt us, now you get to be our colony again. And we're like, no. And the American people basically said no. But it took until 2016 for enough of them to stand up and say no, right? And now we're in the fight for our lives. It's been going on for a decade. So the U.S. has the ability to weather all this because we have the physical and industrial might. We still have the best capital markets in the world. We still have the best rule of law in the world. You know, if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, you're going to do so. And, you know, and you're an American entrepreneur, you're a European entrepreneur, you want to start that business in Beijing, or do you want to start it in the United States? I don't know about you, but I'm thinking Florida looks pretty good. Like Florida corporate law is great. Like, everybody's leaving Delaware. There's a reason for that, right? Get away from the chancery courts in Delaware and a variety of other, all sorts of weird little things that everybody knows, but everybody's conveniently forgotten. No one asks, like, why does everybody incorporate in Delaware? Well, there's good reasons for that. And then what would that, why would it work that way? These are questions that everybody should ask. So the United States is absolutely still a country at war with itself, because we've been set in motion to be at war with ourselves, because that's what the color revolution does. That's the color revolution playbook. The United States was such a strong society in its own way that took 100 years worth of degradation to get us to this state. Okay, it took 100 years. And it looks like, and it still may succeed, but, you know, give Trump some credit for, you know, trying to stop it. Now, if he's succeeding, if he does succeed, and I think the resolution on Iran is one of the markers, one of the signposts as to whether he will succeed or not, Russia and China will be okay with that. Because they know that a United States that's independent and sovereign from the worries of Europe is no longer bound by NATO in the same way that it was in the past, no longer bound by, you know, the our capital markets weren't at the mercy of the offshore dollar system, right? We have to go into that stuff. Then you realize that they have a partner, a potential trade and business partner, for lack of a better term, that they can then start to build long-term relationships with, as opposed to worrying about what the next administration is going to do. So that's why this redistricting fight in the United States is so important, because, you know, if you look at the map after this morning's strike down by the Supreme Court of Virginia's redistricting plan, which a referendum, calling it unconstitutional, Republicans are up like 14 seats. The map for the Democrats to quote unquote steal the midterms or take the midterms is looking increasingly unlikely, because all they have left are toss-ups. They got to win them all. And that's with Trump not winning anything between now and November. And you don't think he's not going to win some major battles between now and November? Like, he's rolling up, you know, the Justice Department under Todd Blanche. Now that Pam Bondi did all the work underneath to fundamentally alter the way the DOJ works, to clean it up to the point where it could actually do the job that we want them to do. Now Todd Blanche is going out and is arresting and indicting all sorts of people. And it's only going to accelerate from here. I mean, Trump just came out this morning and threatened, like, if I believe the story I saw this morning, again, haven't, I'll salt this one to taste because I haven't gotten a corroborative source on this, but I saw, you know, if Trump literally came out today and said Obama was the one that had a guy trying to blow up talks within, you know, in Islamabad, the next time he does that, I'm going to prosecute him under the Logan Act. That would be hilarious. Let's just go arrest Barack Obama. He is a private citizen, after all, and he should be. He should be arrested. He's a freaking traitor. He should be hung. But that's, you know.
So, Tom, I want to go back to what you're saying about the Europe and the narrative that I hear with China and the U.S. and Russia. Mm-hmm. It seems quite different from how you understand maybe where China and U.S. relations are. If you can kind of share your perspective on kind of what you hear in the news, the media regarding that, and that you think is either blatantly false or the, you know, things that you see that people aren't talking about, because this seems to be a very unique perspective than what I'm used to hearing.
Yeah, well, let's think of it this way. So Trump is going to Beijing next week, right? Did anybody not notice that China came out and told Iran to knock it off with its, you know, the straits are closed and we're not going to negotiate, and blah, blah, and then basically the Chinese came out and said, that's enough. That's enough. The Chinese don't want this anymore. They want it over and done with. Like, I've been arguing for a while now that, again, keep moving the globe around and looking at it from different perspectives. Let's move the center of the globe to the Pacific Ocean, shall we? Most people don't like to look at the Pacific Ocean because it's boring. It's a big, flat, blue expanse with Hawaii and Guam and a bunch of land around the outside. But if you notice the land around the outside, it's America, Russia, and China. So why should we be thinking in terms of the BRICS and not ARC? Right?
Huh.
I'm not saying that ARC is going to happen like a formal alliance or anything, because it wouldn't be an alliance. But there's absolutely no reason why the United States and Russia can't. I mean, why did, you know, why can't they have a cordial relationship? Why can't we have a good, why can't we have open relationship between the United States and Russia? We practically share a border. It's why Trump invited Putin to Alaska, to remind everybody of the deep relationship between the Russians and the Americans over Alaska, and the fact that the Bering Strait, you know, that strait is, it's like 3 miles. And this is a guy named Elon Musk, and he's got this thing called the Boring Company, and he could make a tunnel between Russia and Alaska, and we could have a train. Wouldn't that be great? Right? And if Alberta were to leave Canada and the Northwest Territories were to go to Yukon, we could have a train going all the way from like Boise, Idaho, all the way to Cosmina on the Kamchatka Peninsula. Wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be cool? I think it would be cool. Like, I think Russia needs Ford F-150s. Like, seriously. Like, you know, like, why not? They probably need them more than we do. Like, given how, you know, how rugged the terrain is out in Irkutsk and all that, right? So, like when you stop to think about it, the United States, Russia, and China have a lot more in common going forward than they do being adversaries. And if you look at a lot of the tension points between these countries, it's over these geographic choke points where the remnant of the British Empire created these single points of failure. Let's give a perfect example of something like Taiwan. Why is Taiwan important? Why do the neocons, every time Russia and Putin, Trump and Putin try and talk, the first thing you hear out of the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the Economist, the Atlantic, yada, 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 NATO, they all start talking about Trump is doing this and he's keeping taking his eye off the ball in China and Taiwan, China, Taiwan. We get Steve Bannon out there doing his stupid friggin' slovenly grift that he does. That fucking prick, I can't stand that guy. Clearly, and working for the other side, folks, clearly working for the other side. Dude was Jeffrey Epstein's best friend. Like, come on. So, no, it's not. Why is Taiwan important? Because they created Taiwan. Taiwan was created. But let's put all the chip factories in Taiwan. Why? Because it's not China, right? It's China, not China. Like, the British always do this. We have India, not India. Pakistan. We have the United States, not the United States. Canada, right? You got Korea and not Korea, right? North and South Korea. Always, no matter what happens, right? There's always this, there's, you know, there's pode, antipode, right? There's point, antipoint in order to have a tension on the border. India is a perfect example of one that has like three problems, four. You got Pakistan, India, India, China, India, Iran over Baluchistan, or Pakistan, India, Pakistan to the light. And you got Pakistan, Iran, you got Pakistan, Afghanistan. You've got the whole mess, right? You've got, you know, they're desperately trying to create, you know, problems for Russia in South Ossetia, right? Georgia, Armenia, all of that stuff, trying to constantly attack the underbelly there, right? All of these things. And if you look at what Donald Trump has done over the term and a half that he's been president, he's tried to deal with every one of these problems, these places. So what has he done with Taiwan? He's moved it to Arizona. We have hot, dry Taiwan down in Arizona. Yeah. Great. We don't need Taiwan anymore. They're like, the Taiwanese are going to choose to unify with China in 10, 15 years anyway.
Yeah, so you see a world, an arc possible alliance.
Not alliance.
If you will, or where it's more cordial, at least.
Yes, cordial arrangements where we agree on the things we agree with and we agree on, and we disagree on the things we disagree on. But if we remove the choke points and the flash points on, you know, for Russia, it's their Western border. It's their European side, right? And for my dog is desperately wants my attention. She keeps nudging me. You can see her right off the, she's down there. And she's the most charming thing in the world. Yes, Kamina. Sorry, honey. I'm busy right now, sweetheart. I'll pet you in half an hour. Can't not pet the dog. So, and then for the Chinese, it's the same problem. You know, it's access to the shipping lanes in Southeast Asia, right? And getting access to oil and trade, you know, in Africa and all the places that they want to do business with around the world. So you have to, as you know, for them, wouldn't it be great to have the United States not be an adversary in that respect? We can be competitors, right? We can be rivals. We don't have to be adversaries. Someone is trying to make us into adversaries because when you really break it down, and I'll break it down into something that almost everybody's dealt with in their life. You ever deal with a narcissistic and/or abusive friend or parent or anything along those lines? No one's ever dealt with anything like this. I wouldn't know anything about this, right? What do? They triangulate. They triangulate between you and somebody else. So when they don't want you and somebody else to be friends, what do? Well, they sabotage the relationship between the two of you.
And who exactly, Tom, is trying to sabotage and make his adversaries?
London. British, London, Frankfurt, Brussels, Venice, Rome. I don't care who you call it. Everybody has a different name for it, okay? Everybody does. Some people call it the Jews. I'm not a big fan of that one because I just think that they're a pimple on the ass end of power, my personal opinion, okay? I think they're a barnacle, right? Not real power. Real power is vested in the old families of Europe, right? Real power is vested in who controls the flow of capital around the world, who controls oil futures, who controls gold, the pricing of gold, who controls the pricing of euro dollars. These are the three things, and I mean euro dollars and not dollars. I mean euro dollars. They're a very important distinction. And the reason it's an important distinction is because onshore dollars and offshore dollars, let's talk about that for a second. The offshore dollar market is an order of magnitude, if not more, bigger than the domestic dollar market. Okay. Now you have a Federal Reserve tasked with trying to regulate the domestic economy through interest rate policy, right? And access to reserves and all of that stuff. But how is it supposed to do that? And I will give credit now to Jeff Snyder when he used to work for Alhambra Partners, then 15 years ago, was trying to teach this to everybody, that how do you, if the euro dollar markets are what would determine Fed policy, it would be the euro dollar markets getting a cold that would then force the Fed to cut interest rates before it's supposed to. You know, the whole Keynesian countercyclic raise interest rates during an expansion to keep inflation from getting out of control, and then cut interest rates and then, you know, regulate the economy this way, right? That's the argument for why we need a Federal Reserve. I'm not saying I agree with that. I don't actually. I never have. I'm still enough of an Austrian to say no to that. But I understand how the Fed can be used as a tool to reinforce sovereign action within I look at the Federal Reserve as like America's military, but for financial purposes. That's the way I look at it. It's the guarantor of American financial independence, right? If it has a role in the world, that's the way I look at the role it should have going forward. And I honestly think that that's the role that it's being set up to perform in, and not be the central bank of the world, which is what Davos in Europe wanted, Davos and City of London wanted. So the euro dollar system, this is something goes, you and I haven't done this before, because I don't know how many times you've listened to me talk about SOFR versus LIBOR. Like, do you know anything about that conversation that I've
Please.
had with the world? Okay, I'm going to do a
No.
quick one. Most people who watch me talk, they know what I'm talking about when I say these two things. So in 2022, SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, became the debt indexing rate for dollars over LIBOR. It beat out LIBOR. It started under Jerome Powell and what's his name? Don Williams over at the New York Fed, right? Back in 2017, 2018, and then a four-year pilot project, and to roll it out slowly, and then everything is now indexed to SOFR and not LIBOR. Previous to that, for 30 years or so, but going back to 1984, LIBOR was the standard. Everybody would just write their credit revolvers and their car loans and their this, and everything would be priced in LIBOR, plus or minus LIBOR. But what is LIBOR? LIBOR is the price of the demand for euro dollars, because it's City of London based, London Interbank Offered Rate, meaning they were pricing dollars for the entire world. So they were really in control of American monetary policy, because if LIBOR blew out because some German banks got in trouble because they were over-leveraged relative to the German economy, and they were in trouble, and other people were in trouble, what would happen? Well, this would invariably happen whenever the Fed tried to tighten the domestic economy, the supply of dollars globally, and then the euro dollar markets would get a cold first because they were more leveraged than ours were, right? Because their economies were fundamentally weaker than ours, so they're by definition more leveraged. Even at the same leverage ratio, they can't handle the same leverage ratio that we can. So what would happen? The Fed would raise interest rates. They would slow down faster than us. LIBOR would blow out to the upside. It would translate into higher credit revolvers, higher credit card rates, higher car loan rates, and everything else for the United States, and artificially slow our economy down, forcing the Fed to cut interest rates before it was time. And this is where the Austrians at the Mises Institute and others were always correct, and that the Fed always cuts short. But they were making a structural or intellectual argument about this, absent the effect of who was actually causing the slowdown. Mechanistically, their argument was correct. It was just who was actually in charge of that. That's the part they missed. And interestingly enough, they kept missing it all the time. And so after a while, I'm like, it can't be, when things are too stupid to be stupid, they're usually not. But that's a different story. My troubles with the Mises Institute since 2024 are well documented. So now let's think about this in connection to SOFR. What does SOFR do? SOFR says, no, the price for dollars is set in the American domestic repo markets, not offshore. So now, when Jerome Powell raises interest rates to 5.5%, and Peter Schiff is out there screaming that, oh, you can't go above 1% and the US economy will collapse. Zero hedge. Oh, the US economy will collapse. And zero hedge, and then starts turning everything imaginable into QE. All attempts at like at liquidate at reliquifying the system or QE. They're all, oh, everything's QE. Like, no, it's not QE, dude. It's just creating dollars. Creating dollars is not QE. Openly monetizing treasury bonds to artificially suppress prices of to suppress yields on treasury bonds, that's QE, right? The Fed expanding its balance sheet because there's no market for treasuries, that's not QE. When there's a demand for US treasuries because the world wants treasuries, that's not QE. That's called demand. Fuck off.
Thank you,
Like,
Tom.
seriously, seriously, that's just called demand. last I checked, you know, every day we get up and there's more dollars floating around and there's, you know, there's more treasury bonds sitting in central banks, you know. A dollar bear loses his wings. Like, what am I going to do? Like, so SOFR changed the game, Steve. SOFR started the process of the United States finally having control over the price of its own currency. Let's just get out of the weeds of how it works and everything else. And let's just look at elementally, what have we done? We now control the price of dollars. We can control the price of dollars. Now we can start setting actual fiscal policy. Can't set rational fiscal policy if you don't have control of your own currency, right? The price of your own currency. And you're setting the price of your own currency based on the domestic demand for that currency. Everybody else can go hang. If we can afford 5.5% and they can't, well, that's not my problem. Y'all decided to buy all these dollars. That ain't my problem now. Where it's no longer our dollars your problem. It's now our commodity. It's now your commodities potentially our problem. That's fine. That's a different conversation. The next thing for the United States needs to do is get control of the collateral, the value of the collateral. And in this case, that would be who prices gold, who prices silver.
And prices. What would be the playbook for that?
Attack the LBMA and take it off the board, which is exactly what we did last year. And let the price of gold go from $1,800 to $5,500 by just buying the crap out of gold. And yeah, coordinating with China along the way, because we did. You can talk to my friend Vince Lanchi about that. He's got all the receipts of watching the United States and China pass off who's buying silver, who's buying gold. Like when the United States isn't buying because we've got our fill for now, and then we got the Chinese buy for a couple of months, and the Chinese say, "Okay, we're done." And the United States picks up, and then once we were done with gold in the first half of 2025, then we moved to silver. And what would be the last thing? They get control of and all of that. But if you're talking elementally now, then you want to have control over your financial system. You want to have control over your pricing inputs. So you got to have control of your dollar so you can price things rationally. Then you have to be able to get control over and properly price the collateral so that you can now start balancing asset valuations versus liability valuations. And that would mean getting control of the price of gold and or silver so that you can then, because those are your reserves. And what are your reserves? Your reserves, you have savings, right? And then what do you do after you've got savings? Then you go and you invest. Gold, goats, investment, guns, defense, right? Right? Gold, goats, and guns. That's what that metaphor is. Goats are just a metaphor for investment, right? Because that's what they are. You've got enough savings.
I heard also that you really like goats. Is that true or fact or fiction? And if you can, as we land a plane, Tom, if you can tell us what goats and guns is all about. You've mentioned it briefly.
I do like goats. Goats are awesome because, you know, goats are one of the greatest inventions by man, which is that they are an invention just like dogs. They're an invention, right? But we have a great relationship, a 20,000-year-old relationship with a goat because the whole thing is useful. And it can live with us when we're hunter-gatherers. It can live with us when we're sedentary farmers. They produce meat, they produce milk, they produce fiber, they produce hides. The whole thing is used. The whole goat is used. This is like the cow. The cow is an amazing thing as well. Don't get me wrong, but you know, there's like gold cows and guns doesn't work nearly as well. Obviously, I also used to raise goats. Like I used to raise dairy goats and meat goats. So I have, you know, I did so for about 12 years. I don't any longer. But what's important is that, again, to land the plane on this, you get control of gold. Now you have savings. Now you got to get control of what? The pricing of what? That which liquefies the markets, which is oil. Because investment is liquefied, and the rate at which you can invest in new and productive assets is all downstream of how much energy you can procure and what the price of that energy. So wouldn't the United States also want to be the marginal producer of a barrel of oil? And then if they are the marginal producer of a barrel of oil, wouldn't they want control over the price of that barrel of oil and not have it in the hands of somebody else who's then running a volatility grift and making money on both sides of the trade, which is exactly what Iran, City of London, Europe have been doing for God knows how long. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the game. Everything else you're watching on a daily basis is just downstream of all those little, of all that, all the rest of it is just noise. It's all just people operating and moving within, having their little knife fights over the over those big themes. The big theme is that the United States is moving the center of global trade away from the old world, to the new world. And we're finally going to get a chance to see what it looks like if Trump is successful. And I think Russia and China have bought into this because it's best for them as well, because they're no longer having to fight with the old world over their ability to actually be people in the modern world.
So
that's the game. And I think Trump's made that offer to all of them. And I think we're going to find out a lot more in about 9 days when Trump meets with Xi.
Lots to look forward to. Thanks, Tom. Tom, if you can tell us about Gold Goats and Guns, where you are, how people can follow your Substack and what you guys do.
I don't do a Substack. I know everybody else is on Substack. We're not. We're on Patreon. We're Patreon.com/Gold Goats and Guns. It's we do a monthly retail newsletter. I do a couple of what I call market reports on Wednesdays and Sundays, where I go over the headlines and the technical state of the important markets and bond spreads and all the rest of it. And look at gold, silver, Bitcoin, oil, the Dow, and most importantly, all of the stuff that I've talked about today shows up in the spreads between various sovereign debts. And you can watch the marriage, to go back to the original question you asked about narratives and markets and the intersection thereof, you can literally time bond spreads and the movements, tops and bottoms, and various, like US versus UK or US versus German or whatever. You can time them all to big geopolitical events, because what people are really doing at that level, they care about bond prices and the spreads between sovereign debt, because the global financial system really is about hedging risk and hedging currency risk.
Yeah.
Guns, right? And because of that, at the end of the day, that's why you can watch this stuff on a daily basis. And once you have a theory of action as to who everybody's incentives are, then you can start putting, this is where the receipts are. The receipts are in the bond spreads. And, once you start to see it, it's really hard to not see. So I on my the market reports, I put out these charts of like 5 years of the US UK bond spreads and how they move and all the geopolitical events timed to the day of how these things move. And they're like, oh, look, there it is. Same thing with the gold to silver ratio. It's another one. Like very, very tops and bottoms in the gold and silver ratio are tied to big geopolitical moments. They always are. Because silver is an industrial metal, gold is a monetary metal, and you're watching the two of them fight it out. Now, one day silver might become a monetary metal again, but until that happens, the gold-silver ratio is absolutely timed to the interplay between monetary stress and global financial and global industrial stress, demand, basically. So, but that's that. And you can, of course, follow me on Twitter at TFL1728. We got a blog over TomLuongo.me. Every once in a while, I write an article. We have a podcast.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for your time. For everyone listening, I'm just Steve Yang with Natural Resource Stocks, learning alongside you from people smarter and also interesting than me. Thanks, Tom, especially in particular about your perspective on ARK, and I got lots to think about. So lots to look forward to in the next 9 days. And Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. It was good to talk to you.